Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1162. Farewell America, part one. This is being recorded on November 14th of the year 2020. Before I get into the program proper, be aware that the latest iteration of the flash drive, a 32-gigabyte flash drive containing all of my life's work, updated through the late fall of this year, and including many of the COVID-19 programs I've done, will be available shortly. You can find a link with which to order that at the top of the descriptions of the programs on the SpitfireList.com website, or on the top of the Food for Thought descriptions as well. Or you can go to www.kfjc.org and look for the gifts that are available. I don't get any money from this. And by the way, that is, if you itemize tax deductions, that is tax deductible. Be aware also that sister station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, is podcasting the For the Record programs. Again, there are links at the top of the program descriptions and the Food for Thought posts for the podcast. Now, I'm interrupting discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic to talk about some things that are important, and some things that frankly make me want to puke. Trump has been shuffling officials at the Pentagon and replacing them with loyalists, things that have even frightened people at the Pentagon, and people such as retired four-star General Barry McCaffrey. One observer termed this is dictator stuff. At the same time, Trump loyalists, and there are many of them, including some with a paramilitary agenda, have rejected the official results of the election as a steal, unquote. There has been a lot of discussion in the media of conspiracy theories, lumping in things like the QAnon conspiracy and some of the election was stolen things, with things as well documented as the assassination of JFK, his brother Robert, Martin Luther King, and other things. I think many of our journalists are taking great delight in lumping not only things that are not credible, but fascist conspiracy theories as well, with things that are well documented but that they will not touch. There was an editorial in the New York Times not long ago by Farhad Manjoo, that's F-A-R-H-A-D, last name capital M-A-N-J-O-O, termed conspiracy theory, or titled, I should say, Conspiracy Theories Threaten American Democracy. No, it is not conspiracy theories that threaten American democracy. It is conspiracies that killed it a long time ago. American democracy had its brains blown all over the back of a limousine in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd, 1963. And less than 5 years later, JFK's brother Robert was killed by the same forces. Joe Biden's vice president-elect Kamala Harris, when she was Attorney General of California, refused to grant Sharon Sharon his parole, despite the fact that he was demonstrably innocent. Sharon was a patsy, just like Lee Harvey Oswald. We've talked about that at great length in many programs. With her failure to grant Sharon, demonstrably innocent, his parole, Kamala Harris became one of a large, large number of journalists and politicians in this country who became an accessory after the fact to first-degree murder. When the election had been called for Biden, Anne Hidalgo, H-I-D-A-L-G-O, the mayor of Paris, issued the statement, quote, "Welcome back, America." It was reported by many news outlets, including NBC News of November 7th of 2020. That brought to mind the Welcome Back America, a book that was published in 1968 called Farewell America. It was ostensibly authored by someone called James Hepburn, H-E-P-B-U-R-N, like Catherine Hepburn, the last name. It is generally believed, however, to have been put out by French intelligence. It is a somewhat oblique account of the assassination of President Kennedy, which was connected with not only a coup attempt, but attempts on the life of former French President Charles de Gaulle. In our interviews with Jim Biagemio, the author of the book Destiny Betrayed, that was a 25-hour series. I did For the Record programs 1,031 through 1,056. In 1,031, 1,032, and 1,043, we took a look at a speech that JFK made on the floor of the Senate in 1957, in which he called for the independence of Algeria from France as something of a signal event for the granting of independence, true independence, to former colonial territories that were emerging in what we now call the Third World. It was a speech that was far ahead of its time, and for that JFK was labeled a traitor, a communist, etc., by many in the media and in our national security establishment. Charles de Gaulle also had run afoul of not only his own right wing, but the CIA as well, not only for his attempts at granting Algeria its independence, but also for steering an independent course for France from NATO. For that reason, both or elements of the OAS, l'Organisation de l'Armée Secrète, the secret army organization, and elements of CIA collaborating with them, sought the overthrow and eventually the assassination of Charles de Gaulle. It is believed by many that the oblique book Farewell America, ostensibly authored by, quote, James Hepburn, unquote, was an attempt at by French intelligence for to basically leak out a bit of the truth. I am borrowing from that title of Farewell America for this and the next program. Again, listening to, well, American democracy is threatened, it just makes me want to puke. No, American democracy isn't threatened. It was killed a long time ago. And we are going to take a look at the attempts by the OAS and collaborating elements in Alan Dulles' CIA from a book called The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government, authored by David Talbot, the founder and editor-in-chief of Salon.com, published in hardcover in 2015 by the Talbot Players. By the way, I would note that as we looked at in our discussions with Jim Biagemio, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, one of Guy Bannister's investigators in New Orleans and an American Nazi, boasted of having transferred a large sum of money from the CIA to French officers to overthrow Charles de Gaulle. The late unfortunate Maurice Brooks Gatlin was killed when he either jumped or was pushed from a high-rise hotel window in Panama in 1965. So that closed that chapter. We talked about Maurice Brooks Gatlin, by the way, and his links to the American Nazi Party in For the Record 1188. The brilliant political comedian Mort Saul, one of the people who inspired me to do what I do, noted in his autobiography Heartland in 1976, quote, "How many lies before you belong to the lie?" Saul, by the way, was one of Jim Garrison's investigators. Indeed, I think in America, we now belong to the lie. And by way of supplementing not only Anne Hidalgo's remarks, Welcome Back, America, but to underpin the, quote, James Hepburn, unquote, book, Farewell America. We are going to take a look at David Talbot's accounts of the attempts to overthrow Charles de Gaulle and to kill him, and the collaboration of elements of Alan Dulles' CIA with that. Turning to The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. The strange events that occurred in Paris in April of 1961 reinforced the disturbing feeling that President Kennedy was not in control of his own government. Paris was in turmoil. At dawn on Saturday morning, April 22nd, a group of retired French generals had seized power in Algiers to block President Charles de Gaulle from settling the long, bloody war for Algerian independence. Rumors quickly spread that the coup plotters were coming next for de Gaulle himself, and that the skies over Paris would soon be filled with battle-hardened paratroopers and French foreign legionnaires from Algeria. Gripped by the dying convulsions of its colonial reign, France braced for a calamitous showdown. The threat to French democracy was actually even more immediate than feared. On Saturday evening, two units of paratroopers totaling over 2,000 men huddled in the forest of Orléans and the forest of Rambouillet, not more than an hour outside Paris. The rebellious paratroopers were poised for the final command to join up with tank units from Rambouillet and converge on the capital with the aim of seizing the Élysée Palace and other key government posts. By Sunday, panic was sweeping through Paris. All air traffic was halted over the area, the metro was shut down, and cinemas were dark. Only the cafes remained open, where Parisians crowded anxiously to swap the latest gossip. News that the coup was being led by the widely admired Maurice Chablais, C-H-A-L-L-E, a former Air Force chief and commander of French forces in Algeria, stunned the government in Paris from de Gaulle on down. Chablais, a squat, quiet man, was a World War II hero and, so it had seemed, a loyal Gaullist. But the savage passions of the war in Algeria had deeply affected Chablais and left him vulnerable to the persuasions of more zealous French officers. He had promised Algeria's French settlers and pro-French Muslims that they would not be abandoned, and he felt a soldierly responsibility to stand by his oath, as well as by the memory of the French servicemen who had lost their lives in the war. In his radio broadcast to the people of France, the coup leader explained that he was taking his stand against de Gaulle's, quote, government of capitulation, so that our dead shall not have died for nothing, unquote. De Gaulle quickly concluded that Chablais must be acting with the support of U.S. intelligence, and Élysée officials began spreading this word to the press. Shortly before his resignation from the French military, Chablais had served as NATO commander-in-chief, and he had developed close relations with a number of high-ranking U.S. officers stationed in the military alliance's Fontainebleau headquarters. Chablais and American security officials shared a deep disaffection with de Gaulle. The stubborn 70-year-old pillar of French nationalism was viewed as a growing obstacle to U.S. ambitions for NATO because he refused to incorporate French troops under Allied command and insisted on building a separate nuclear force beyond Washington's control. De Gaulle's enemies in Paris and Washington were also convinced that the French president's awkward steps toward granting Algerian independence threatened to create a, quote, Soviet base, unquote, in strategic, oil-rich North Africa. In panic-gripped Paris, reports of U.S. involvement in the coup filled newspapers across the political spectrum. Geneviève Tabouis, T-A-B-O-U-I-S, a columnist for Paris Jour, zeroed in directly on Alan Dulles as the main culprit in an article headlined, The Strategy of Alan Dulles, unquote. Other news reports revealed that Jacques Soustelle, a former governor general of Algeria who joined the secret army organization, l'Organisation de l'Armée Secrète, or OAS, a notorious anti-De Gaulle terrorist group, had a luncheon meeting with Richard Bissell in Washington the previous December. De Gaulle's foreign ministry was the source of some of the most provocative charges in the press, including the allegation that CIA agents sought funding for the Chalet coup from multinational corporations, such as Belgian mining companies operating in the Congo. Ministry officials also alleged that Americans with ties to extremist groups had surfaced in Paris during the coup drama, including one identified as a, quote, political counselor for the Loose Media Group, unquote, who was heard to say, quote, an operation is being prepared in Algiers to put a stop to communism, and we will not fail as we did in Cuba, unquote. By the way, the Loose Group is Henry Loose, publisher of A Time Life. Continuing. Stories about the CIA's French intrigues soon began spreading to the American press. A Paris correspondent for the Washington Post reported that Chalet had launched his revolt, quote, because he was convinced he had unqualified American support, unquote. Assurances, Chalet was led to believe, emanating from President Kennedy himself, unquote. Who gave these assurances? The Post reporter asked his French sources. The Pentagon? The CIA? It's the same thing, he was told. Dulles was forced to issue a strong denial of CIA involvement in the putsch. Quote, any reports or allegations that the Central Intelligence Agency or any of its personnel had anything to do with the general's revolt were completely false, unquote, the spymaster declared, blaming Moscow for spreading the charges. C.L. Sulzberger, the CIA-friendly New York Times columnist, took up the agency's defense, echoing Dulles' indignant denial. Quote, to set the record straight, Sulzberger wrote, sounding like an agency official, our government behaved with discretion, wisdom, and propriety during the French insurrection. This applies to all branches, including the CIA, unquote. Years later, investigative reporter Carl Bernstein exposed the ties between Sulzberger and the CIA. Quote, young Cy Sulzberger had some uses, unquote, a CIA official told Bernstein. Quote, he was very eager. He loved to cooperate, unquote. Bernstein conveniently left unexamined the long history of cooperation between the CIA and his own former employer, the Washington Post. But the New York Times' Scotty Reston was more aligned with the sentiments of the Kennedy White House. Echoing the charges circulating in the French press, Reston reported that the CIA was indeed, quote, involved in an embarrassing liaison with the anti-Gaullist officers, unquote. Reston communicated the rising fury in JFK's inner circle over the CIA's rogue behavior in the wake of the Bay of Pigs fiasco and the French escapade, quote, all this has increased the feeling in the White House that the CIA has gone beyond the bounds of an objective intelligence-gathering agency and has become the advocate of men and policies that have embarrassed the administration, unquote. Alan Dulles was once again making his own policy, this time in France. There was a long history of acrimony between Dulles and De Gaulle dating back to World War II and the complex internal policies of the French resistance. As OSS chief in Switzerland, Dulles favored a far-right faction of the resistance that was opposed to De Gaulle. In his war memoirs, De Gaulle accused Dulles of being part of a, quote, scheme, unquote, that was determined to silence or set aside, unquote, the French general. Pierre de Benouville, a right-wing resistance leader on Dulles' OSS payroll, was later accused of betraying Jean Moulin, M-O-U-L-I-N, De Gaulle's dashing representative in the French underground to the Gestapo. After he was captured, Moulin was subjected to brutal torture before being beaten to death by the notorious war criminal Klaus Barbie. After de Gaulle was elected president in 1958, he sought to purge the French government of its CIA-connected elements. Dulles had made heavy inroads into France's political, cultural, and intelligence circles in the post-war years. According to some French reports, during his visits to Paris, the spy master would set himself up at a suite in the Ritz Hotel, where he would dispense bags full of cash to friendly politicians, journalists, and other influential figures. Some were wined and dined and enticed with beautiful Parisian call girls. De Gaulle was particularly determined to shut down the secret stay-behind army, unquote, that Dulles had organized in France, a network of anti-communist militants with access to buried arms caches who were originally recruited to resist a potential Soviet invasion but were now aligned with the rebellious generals and other groups plotting to overthrow French democracy. De Gaulle ordered his young security advisor, Konstantin Melnik, to shut down the murky, stay-behind network of fascists, spooks, and criminals, which Melnik agreed was, quote, very dangerous for the security of France, unquote. But Melnik, M-E-L-N-I-K, who was trained at the RAND Corporation, a leading think tank for the U.S. national security complex, was another admirer of Dulles, and the stay-behind underground continued to operate in France. Melnik, who was the son of a white Russian general and the grandson of Tsar Nicholas II's personal physician, who was executed along with the imperial family, was as passionately anti-Soviet as his U.S. security colleagues. In May of 1958, when de Gaulle returned to power in Paris after a 12-year absence, Dulles flew to Paris for a face-to-face meeting with the legendary Frenchman to see if their differences could be resolved. Dulles had great confidence in his personal powers of persuasion, but the proud de Gaulle refused to see the spy master, handing him off to one of his close associates, Michel Debré, D-E-B-R-E. A formal dinner was organized for Dulles and Jim Hunt, the CIA station chief in Paris, which was also attended by Konstantin Melnik. Dulles seemed unfazed by de Gaulle's slight, but as French journalist Frédéric Charpier later commented, quote, upon returning to the Ritz Hotel, Dulles drew some lessons from the evening which confirmed his fears. De Gaulle promised to be a tough and hostile partner who was sure to put an end to the laissez-faire attitude which, up until then, had characterized the French government, unquote. World leaders defied Dulles at their peril, even leaders like Charles de Gaulle, whose nation's warm fraternal relations with the U.S. dated back to the American Revolution. After Dulles flew home to Washington, the CIA's reports on de Gaulle took a sharper edge. At a National Security Council meeting convened by Eisenhower in September of 1958, gloomy prognostications were made about the French leader's ability to settle the Algerian crisis to America's satisfaction. The possibility of overthrowing de Gaulle and replacing him with someone more in tune with U.S. interests was openly discussed, but the idea was discarded at that point as too risky. However, by the time Kennedy took office in January of 1961, the CIA was primed for a power switch in Paris. On January 26th, Dulles sent a report to the new president on the French situation that seemed to be preparing Kennedy for de Gaulle's imminent elimination without giving any hint of the CIA's own involvement in the plot. Quote, a pre-revolutionary atmosphere reigns in France, Dulles informed JFK. The Army and the Air Force are staunchly opposed to de Gaulle, the spymaster continued, exaggerating the extent of the military opposition as if to present the demise of the French president as a fait accompli. Quote, at least 80% of the officers are violently against him. They haven't forgotten that in 1958 he had given his word of honor that he would never abandon Algeria. He is now reneging on his promise, and they hate him for that. De Gaulle surely won't last if he tries to let go of Algeria. Everything will probably be over for him by the end of the year. He will be either deposed or assassinated, unquote. Dulles clearly knew much more, but he wasn't sharing it with Kennedy. When the coup against de Gaulle began 3 months later, Kennedy was still in the dark. It was a tumultuous time for the young administration. As he continued to wrestle with the fallout from the Bay of Pigs crisis, JFK was suddenly besieged with howls of outrage from a major ally, accusing his own security services of seditious activity. It was a stinging embarrassment for the new American president, who was scheduled to fly to Paris for a state visit the following month. To add to the insult, the coup had been triggered by de Gaulle's efforts to bring French colonial rule in Algeria to an end, a goal that JFK himself had ardently championed. The CIA's support for the coup was one more defiant display of contempt, a back of the hand aimed not only at de Gaulle, but at Kennedy. JFK took pains to assure Paris that he strongly supported de Gaulle's presidency, phoning Hervé Alphon, the French ambassador in Washington, to directly communicate these assurances. But according to Alphon, Kennedy's disavowal of official U.S. involvement in the coup came with a disturbing addendum. The American president could not vouch for his own intelligence agency. Kennedy told Alphon that, quote, "The CIA is such a vast and poorly controlled machine that the most unlikely maneuvers might be true," unquote. This admission of presidential impotence, which Alphon reported to Paris, was a startling moment in U.S. foreign relations. It remains largely unknown today. Kennedy then underlined how deeply estranged he was from his own security machinery by taking the extraordinary step of asking Alphon for the French government's help to track down the U.S. officials who were behind the coup, promising to fully punish them. Quote, "Kennedy would be quite ready to take all necessary measures in the interest of good Franco-American relations, whatever the rank or functions of the incriminated people," unquote, Alphon cabled French Foreign Minister Maurice Couvet du Merville, M-U-R-V-I-L-L-E. To solidify his support for de Gaulle, Kennedy ordered the U.S. Ambassador James Gavin, G-A-V-I-N, to offer the French leader any help, unquote, he might need, clearly indicating that U.S. troops would even fire on rebel forces from Algeria if they tried to land at American military bases in France. De Gaulle proudly declined the offer as, quote, "well-intentioned but inappropriate," unquote, perhaps horrified at the prospect of American GIs killing French soldiers on his nation's soil. But Kennedy did arrange for U.S. base commanders to take steps to camouflage landing sites in case rebel planes attempted to use them. In the wake of the crises in Cuba and France, provoked by his own security officials, Kennedy began to display a new boldness. JFK's assertiveness surprised CIA officials, who had apparently counted on Kennedy to be sidelined during the French coup. Agency officials assured coup leaders that the president would be too, quote, "absorbed in Cuban affair," unquote, to act decisively against the plot. But JFK did react quickly to the French crisis, putting on high alert Ambassador Gavin, a decorated paratrooper commander himself in World War II, who could be counted on to keep NATO forces in line. The president also dispatched his French speaking press spokesman Pierre Salinger to Paris to communicate directly with Élysée Palace officials. As Paris officials knew, the new American president already had something of a prickly relationship with de Gaulle, but he had strong feelings for France, and they made sure to absolve JFK of personal responsibility for the coup in their leaks to the press. French press accounts referred to the CIA as a, quote, "reactionary state within a state," unquote, that operated outside of Kennedy's control. After JFK's death, Alphon spoke fondly of the bonds between Kennedy and France. Quote, "He thought that harmonious relations between the U.S. and France were a fundamental element of world equilibrium. He knew France as a boy. He came to France for his holidays, the south of France, and he knew France also through his wife, Jacqueline, who had made many, many trips to Paris. I know that Jacqueline helped him very much to understand France. She loves France. She has French blood. She speaks our language very well, and she asked him to read the memoirs of General de Gaulle, unquote. Kennedy's strong show of support for de Gaulle undoubtedly helped fortify French resolve against the rebellious generals. In the midst of the crisis, the American president issued a public message to de Gaulle telling him, quote, "In this grave hour for France, I want you to know of my continuing friendship and support as well as that of the American people," unquote. But it was de Gaulle himself and the French people who turned the tide against the coup. By Sunday, the second day of the coup, a dark foreboding had settled over Paris. Quote, "I am surprised that you are still alive," unquote, the president of France's National Assembly bluntly told de Gaulle that morning. Quote, "If I were Chalet, I would have already swooped down on Paris. The army here will move out of the way rather than shoot. If I were in the position Chalet put himself in, as soon as I'd burst in, I would have you executed with a bullet in the back here in the stairwell and say you were trying to flee," unquote. De Gaulle himself realized that if Chalet did airlift his troops from Algiers to France, quote, "there was not much to stop them," unquote. But at 8 o'clock that evening, a defiant de Gaulle went on the air as nearly all of France gathered around the TV and rallied his nation with the most inspiring address of his long public career. He looked exhausted, with dark circles under his eyes, but he had put on his soldier's uniform for the occasion, and his voice was full of passion. De Gaulle began by denouncing the rebellious generals. The nation had been betrayed, quote, "by men whose duty, honor, and raison d'etre it was to serve and to obey," unquote. Now, it was the duty of every French citizen to protect the nation from these military traitors. Quote, "In the name of France," de Gaulle shouted, thumping the table in front of them, "I order that all means, I repeat, all means be employed to block the road everywhere to those men," unquote. De Gaulle's final words were a battle cry. "Française, Français, aidez-moi," translating that means "French women, Frenchmen, help me." And all over France, millions of people did rush to the aid of their nation. The following day, a general strike was organized to protest the putsch. Led primarily by the left, including labor unions and the Communist Party, the mass protest won broad political support. Over 10 million people joined the nationwide demonstrations, with hundreds of thousands marching in the streets of Paris, carrying banners proclaiming, quote, "Peace in Algeria," unquote, and shouting, "Fascism will not pass," unquote. Even police officers' associations expressed, quote, "complete solidarity," unquote, with the protests, as did the Roman Catholic Confederation, which denounced the criminal acts, unquote, of the coup leaders, warning that they threatened to plunge the country into civil war, unquote. Hundreds of people rushed to the nation's airfields and prepared to block the runways of their vehicles if Chalet's planes tried to land. Others gathered outside government ministries in Paris to guard them against attack. André Malraux, the great novelist turned minister of culture, threaded his way through one such crowd, handing out helmets and uniforms. Meanwhile, at the huge Renault factory on the outskirts of Paris, workers took control of the sprawling complex and formed militias, demanding weapons from the government so that they could fend off rebel assaults. Quote, "In many ways, France, and particularly Paris, relived its great revolutionary past Sunday night and Monday, the past of the revolutionary barricades, of vigilance committees, and the workers' councils, reported the New York Times. De Gaulle's ringing address to the nation and the massive public response had a sobering effect on the French military. Chalais's support began quickly melting away, even humiliatingly, within the ranks of his own military branch, the Air Force. Pilots flew their planes out of Algeria, and others feigned mechanical troubles, depriving Chalais's troops of the air transport they needed to descend on Paris. Meanwhile, de Gaulle moved quickly to arrest military officers in France who were involved in the coup. Police swooped down on the Paris apartment of an army captain who was plotting pro-Putsch street riots, and de Gaulle's Minister of the Interior seized the general in charge of the rebel forces that were gathered in the forests outside Paris. Deprived of their leader, the insurrectionary units sheepishly began to disperse. By Tuesday night, Chalais knew that the coup had failed. The next day, he surrendered and was flown to Paris. Chalais emerged from the plane, quote, carrying his own suitcase, looking crumpled and insignificant in civilian clothes, unquote, according to Time magazine. Again quoting, he stumbled at the foot of the landing steps, falling heavily on his hands and knees. It was an ignominious homecoming for the man who had fully believed that with U.S. support, he was to replace the great de Gaulle. Chalais expected to face a firing squad, but de Gaulle's military tribunal proved surprisingly merciful, sentencing the 55-year-old general to 15 years in prison. After the failed coup, de Gaulle launched a new purge of his security forces. He ousted General Paul Gossin, P-O-S-S-I-N, the powerful chief of SDECE, the French Secret Service, and he shut down its armed unit, the 11th Shock, C-H-O-C, or Shock Battalion, which he suspected of being a breeding ground for the coup one more time. He, de Gaulle, ousted General Paul Gossin, the powerful chief of SDECE, the French Secret Service, and he shut down its armed unit, the 11th Shock Battalion, which he suspected of being a breeding ground for the coup. Gossin, who was closely aligned with the CIA, had told Frank Wisner over lunch that the return of de Gaulle to power was equivalent to the communists taking over in Paris. The 11th Shock had grown into a dangerously unhinged killing unit, targeting representatives of the Algerian independence movement and their European supporters, even on the streets of France. Those branded enemies of the French Empire were gunned down, blown up, or poisoned by SDECE's action arm. Aided by ex-Nazi agents of Reinhard Gehlen's organization, the 11th Shock's assassination campaign reached the point where, quote, liquidations were an almost daily routine, unquote, according to Philippe Parot de Vaugirie, a veteran SDECE agent who served as the liaison to the CIA. Shortly after pushing out Gossin, de Gaulle also jettisoned his security advisor, Constantine Melnick, Dulles' close ally. Late into his life, Melnick continued to insist that the CIA was always a friend to de Gaulle, which would have come as a surprise to the French president. Writing in his 1999 memoir, Politically Incorrect, Melnick flatly declared, quote, I can testify that, despite suspicious yelping by Gaullist camp followers, the CIA always was a faithful ally of General de Gaulle, even of his own torturous Algerian policies, unquote. After de Gaulle dumped Melnick, Dulles, who by then had also been fired, immediately offered to hire him for a new private intelligence agency he was planning in the Third World. But Melnick declined, instead pursuing a career in French publishing and politics. for the rest of his 10-year presidency, which ended with his retirement from politics in 1969, de Gaulle continued to take strong countermeasures against forces he regarded as seditious threats. In 1962, he expelled CIA Station Chief Alfred Ulmer, a gung-ho veteran of Dulles' Cold War backgrounds. And, by the way, parenthetically, as we saw in our discussions with Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, Alfred Ulmer was also a close friend of George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named. In 1967, de Gaulle evicted NATO from... Beginning one more time. In 1967, de Gaulle evicted NATO from France to regain, quote, full sovereignty over French territory, unquote, after discovering that the military alliance was encouraging Western European secret services to interfere in France's domestic politics. Following the Algiers putsch, de Gaulle remained an assassination target, particularly during the explosive months before and after he finally recognized Algerian independence in July of 1962. The most dramatic attempt on his life was staged the next month by the OAS, an ambush made famous in the Frederick Forsyth novel and movie The Day of the Jackal. As de Gaulle's black citoyen sped along the Avenue de la Libération in Paris with the president and his wife in the rear seat, a dozen OAS snipers opened fire on the vehicle. Two of the president's motorcycle bodyguards were killed, and the bullet-riddled citoyen skidded sharply. But de Gaulle was fortunate to have a skilled and loyal security team, and his chauffeur was able to pull the car out of its spin and speed to safety despite all four tires being shot out. The president and his wife, who kept their heads down throughout the fusillade, escaped unharmed. The French president demonstrated that he was willing to fight fire with fire. According to de Vaugirard, the Gaulle loyalists in SDECE even recruited their own secret assassins, including a particularly violent group of Vietnamese exiles who blew up cafes in Algeria frequented by enemies of de Gaulle and kidnapped, tortured, and murdered other OAS combatants deemed a threat to the president. Democracy in France in the early 1960s was sustained as a result of a vicious underground war that the old French general was willing to fight with equal ferocity. Parenthetically, that organization, the counter-OAS, were called the SAC, the Service de l'Action Civique. Continuing. Because of the severe security measures he took, Charles de Gaulle survived his tumultuous presidency. He died of a heart attack the year after he left office, just short of his 80th birthday, slumping over quietly in his armchair after watching the evening news. President Kennedy met only once with de Gaulle on his state visit to Paris at the end of May of 1961, a month after the failed coup. The president and the First Lady were feted at a banquet in Élysée Palace, where the old general, dazzled by Jackie, leaned down closely to hear every breathy word she spoke to him in fluent French. During the three-day visit, the two heads of the state discussed many pressing issues from Laos to Berlin to Cuba. But Kennedy and de Gaulle never broached the touchy subject of the coup, much less the CIA's involvement in it. As French journalist Vincent Jolivet later observed, quote, "Why wake up old demons who had barely fallen asleep?" unquote. Kennedy knew that he would have to resume wrestling with those demons as soon as he returned home. He would have to decide how deeply to purge his own security agencies, as de Gaulle had already begun to do in France. Kennedy knew there would be steep political costs involved in taking on the CIA and the Pentagon. Well, yes, indeed. And they proved lethal. I remember as a freshman in high school watching the funeral of JFK, and seeing a French President Charles de Gaulle in his military uniform. He, by the way, was the leader of the Free French Forces in World War II, and I remember seeing de Gaulle in his uniform. I had no idea at the time how much de Gaulle must have known about what had actually taken place. And later on, in The Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot mentions that an OAS sniper and terrorist named Jean, Souetre, S-O-U-E-T-R-E, was arrested in Dallas, Texas, and deported to Mexico. Talbot writes, "In fact, among the strange and murderous characters who converged on Dallas in November of 1963 was a notorious French OAS commando named Jean Souetre, who was connected to the plots against President de Gaulle. Souetre was arrested in Dallas after the Kennedy assassination and expelled to Mexico. Souetre's expulsion brought an urgent inquiry from French intelligence officials to the CIA about the dangerous outlaw's likely whereabouts, since de Gaulle was about to travel to Mexico for a state visit." There have been a number of theories about the Kennedy assassination, that underground French elements from the French far right, the French fascists, to elements of French organized crime were among the elements at the operation level in the JFK assassination. Now remember that, as I mentioned earlier, JFK, in a speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate in 1957, had championed Algerian independence. Remember also that one of Guy Bannister's investigators, Maurice Brooks Gatman, an attorney for American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, had boasted of having transferred a large sum of money from the CIA to French generals who were plotting to overthrow Charles de Gaulle. And Maurice Brooks Gatman was killed in a fall or jump from a high-rise window in a hotel in Panama in 1965. In The Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot writes about de Gaulle's insights into what happened to JFK and links them to what almost happened to him. As we watch what is taking place in the U.S. in mid-November of 2020, and as we recall the, frankly, to me at least, ironic words of Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, "Welcome back, America." I think "farewell, America," a long ago farewell, would be far more appropriate. In The Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot writes of de Gaulle's reflections on the assassination of JFK. "Suspicions of a conspiracy were particularly strong in France, where President de Gaulle himself had been the target of CIA machinations and had survived a barrage of gunfire on his own limousine. After returning from Kennedy's November 24th funeral in Washington, de Gaulle gave a remarkably candid assessment of the assassination to his information minister, Alain Perfit," that's P-E-Y-R-E-F-I-T-T-E, quote, "What happened to Kennedy is what nearly happened to me," unquote, confided the French president, again quoting, "His story is the same as mine. It looks like a cowboy story, only it's an OAS, Secret Army Organization, story. The security forces were in cahoots with the extremists," unquote. As a matter of survival, de Gaulle and his loyal deputies had been compelled to investigate the underworld where intelligence forces, political zealots, and gangsters all converge. More than any other Western leader, he was well aware of how security services, in the name of combating communism, joined hands with some of the most extreme and vicious allies to win their goals. De Gaulle was convinced that Kennedy had fallen victim to the same forces that had tried repeatedly to kill him. "Do you think Oswald was a front, Perfit?" asked De Gaulle. Quote, "Everything leads me to believe it," he replied. "They got their hands on this communist who wasn't one while still being one. He had a subpar intellect and was an exalted fanatic, just the man they needed, the perfect one to be accused. The guy ran away because he probably became suspicious. They wanted to kill him on the spot before he could be grabbed by the judicial system. Unfortunately, it didn't happen exactly the way they probably planned it would, but the trial, you realize, is just terrible. People would have talked. They would have dug up so much," unquote. "They would have unearthed everything. Then the security forces went looking for a clean-up man that they totally controlled and who couldn't refuse their offer, and that guy sacrificed himself to kill the fake assassin, supposedly in defense of Kennedy's memory." "Baloney," said De Gaulle. "Security forces all over the world are the same when they do this kind of dirty work. As soon as they succeed in wiping out the fake assassin, they declare that the justice system no longer need be concerned, that no further public action was needed now that the guilty perpetrator was dead. Better to assassinate an innocent man than to let a civil war break out. Better an injustice than disorder." Quote, "America is in danger of upheavals, but you'll see, all of them together will observe the law of silence. They will close ranks. They will do everything to stifle any scandal. They will throw Noah's cloak over those shameful deeds. In order not to lose face in front of the whole world, in order to not risk unleashing riots in the U.S., in order to preserve the nation and to avoid a new civil war, in order to not ask themselves questions. They don't want to know. They don't want to find out. They won't allow themselves to find out," unquote. These astonishing observations about Dallas were captured in Perfit's memoir, C'était De Gaulle, It Was De Gaulle, which was published in France in 2002, 3 years after the author's death. Snippets about the conversation appeared in the U.S. press, but the book was not translated and published in America, and De Gaulle's remarks about the Kennedy assassination were never fully reported outside of France. A half century later, this extraordinary commentary by the French reader, a political colossus of the 20th century, remains one of the most disturbing and insightful perspectives on this traumatic American event. They don't want to find out. They won't allow themselves to find out. Alan Dulles knew the danger of words, the wrong kind of words. As CIA director, he has spent an untold fortune each year on countering the Soviet propaganda machine and controlling the world's conversation, including the political and media dialogue in his own country. Within minutes of the Kennedy assassination, the CIA tried to steer news reporting and commentary about Dallas, planting stories that suggested falsely that Oswald was a Soviet agent or that Castro was behind JFK's murder. In actuality, both Khrushchev, who broke down weeping in the Kremlin when he heard the news, and Castro were deeply distressed by Kennedy's death. Both men had been greatly encouraged by Kennedy's peace initiatives in the final year of his presidency, and they feared that his assassination meant that military hardliners would take control in Washington. Quote, "This is bad news," unquote, Castro muttered to a visiting French journalist who was carrying an olive branch from Kennedy when the Cuban leader was informed of the gunfire in Texas. "Everything is changed," unquote. Castro immediately predicted that the agency would try to pin the murder on him, and sure enough, as the Cuban leader and French journalist Jean Daniel listened to a U.S. radio. A broadcaster suddenly connected Oswald to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. But despite the CIA's strenuous efforts, press coverage of the Kennedy assassination began spinning out of its control. Dulles knew that immediate steps must be taken to contain the conversation. One of his first concerns was the Washington echo chamber itself. He quickly realized the danger posted by an explosive piece in the Washington Post by former President Harry Truman, which instantly caught fire and inspired similar anti-CIA editorials in newspapers from Charlotte, North Carolina, to Sacramento, California. Syndicated columnist Richard Starnes, S-T-A-R-N-E-S, a bit more of the spy agency, used the Truman op-ed to launch a broadside against the CIA, calling it, quote, a cloudy organism of uncertain purpose and appalling power. And, yes, indeed, but it didn't make a whole lot of difference in the long run, did it? And, again, bear in mind the words here of Charles de Gaulle. America is in danger immediately after the assassination. America is in danger of upheavals. But you'll see, all of them together will observe the law of silence. They will close ranks. They will do everything to stifle any scandal. They will throw Noah's cloak over those shameful deeds in order to not lose face in front of the whole world, in order to not risk unleashing riots in the U.S., in order to preserve the Union and to avoid the new Civil War. In order to not ask themselves, they don't want questions that they do not want to know. They don't want to find out. They won't allow themselves to find out, unquote. And as noted here, a half century later, this extraordinary commentary by the French leader, a political colossus of the 20th century, remains one of the most disturbing and insightful perspectives on this traumatic American event. They don't want to find out. They won't allow themselves to find out. And indeed, among the people of whom that might be said is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who again, as California Attorney General, refused the parole of Sirhan Sirhan, the patsy for the murder of JFK's brother Robert, who had clinched the Democratic nomination for president in 1968 in the California primary, just before being murdered. And, that really pretty much, serves as something of an illustration of what de Gaulle was saying. They don't want to know. They don't want to find out. And order will be preserved. And this is what we have seen. So, again, I think that Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo's statement, "Welcome back, America," really might be more appropriately transmogrified as "Farewell, America," the title of the, quote, James Hepburn, unquote, book put out by French intelligence, an oblique account of the JFK assassination, which, as we see, was not only parallel to the assassination attempts and coup attempts against former French President Charles de Gaulle, but was linked to them, with people like Maurice Brooks-Gatlin, René Sleipa, and others providing part of that link. This concludes For the Record program number 1162, Farewell America Part 1. This is being recorded on November 14th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.